Thanks for joining us for this edition of Education Transformation. In today's podcast topic, we're going to be discussing 10 new teaching techniques.
So, Lee, you and I have been in the classroom for a while, and there's a few things we've picked up over the years, either through experience or through research or from other trainers and assessors to help us enhance the student's learning experience. So we're going to look at some of those today.
Yeah, we have, Kate. Yeah, that's right. Look, it's great to experience some of these things yourself and trial some of these techniques yourself in the classroom. It's also a wonderful experience to share peer-to-peer wise with regards to colleagues within your program area. And then it's also a great privilege to observe other trainers delivering completely different subject content where we don't have our vocational skills in, but where you can sit back and just observe the teaching techniques, because that's when it's a great privilege to learn and observe about what works and what doesn't within different people's delivery.
Yeah, and sometimes it will work in the industry or vocation you're in, and for others it doesn't. It is, and sometimes it's a matter of trial and error as well, trying things several times until you get familiar with them before they work really well. So sometimes don't throw it out just because it didn't work the first time. It might just need a bit of tweaking, or it might need a bit more preparation. But try a few times before you actually think, no, this doesn't actually work for me. Because sometimes it's just that experience and familiarity required before it actually really gels.
Yeah. And I also, perhaps it's also worth considering that on the odd occasion, you'll just get a cohort that just will not engage.
Yes.
I've taught probably hundreds and hundreds of students over the years, but I've had that occur once in about 2006, where the cohort just did not engage, and it still haunts me today.
what did I do wrong?
I don't know why. Nevertheless, it's not always our fault.
No. So let's have a look at probably one of the first things you learned as an instructor way back 20 odd years ago that a manager said to you. So do you want to share that?
Yeah, so obviously when we join a teaching faculty and start our journey in developing our teaching skills and our assessment skills, we arrive at a vocational education institution as a subject matter expert. And that's why we're hired, really. Yeah. And I had a great education manager when I first arrived within TAFE SA. And that was in 2001, I think. And he sat me down and he said, Lee, thanks so much for joining our faculty. It's going to be great. We don't have the skills or the vocational knowledge that you have, and that's why we've hired you. So thanks so much for becoming a part of our organisation. And now, if you don't mind, I'm going to teach you how to teach for the next 2 years. Basically, I'm gonna re-educate you and develop a whole new vocational experience for you so that you're going to be capable as a teacher in the classroom. And I thought that was fantastic initially. I thought that was great. Then he went on to say, the first thing I'm going to ask you to do is to, after we finish this meeting, is to go away and spend an hour writing down all of your industry experiences, all of your fantastic stories that you've got tucked away. Write them down and put them in your bottom drawer of your desk. And I thought that was a bit odd initially. And he said, because I guarantee you, over the next 10 years, you're going to forget those experiences, those vocational experiences that are so real, and that's why we've hired you. So I want you to go and write them down. And I was skeptical. Mm-hmm. But 20 years on, you know, I'm sort of glad that I did write them down.
Yeah. Because that application of being able to contextualize what you're teaching for the student, those stories are an integral part of bridging that divide.
Yeah.
And you do forget. Mm. You know, if you're in the classroom 90% of the time, or it's a while since you've been in industry, you're only working in industry part-time now, there's less of those learning opportunities to transfer to the students. So it is really important to write them down to remember, and perhaps even to jot down, you know, what it relates to in the teaching field, not just the stories, but it could relate to this part or this part of the industry.
Yeah.
And so really break it down so that you can go, oh, I've got this, this and this that I can use in examples for these three different topics.
Yes, yes. And if you can teach from passion and from experience, it's so much easier than teaching from the textbook or from the PowerPoint that someone else has created and you've got to follow it word for word. It's so much more easier because it becomes so much more engaging and the students participate then because they want to learn from you as an individual.
I guess that kind of moves on nicely to another consideration that's really important when we're teaching and assessing is maintaining standards.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we need to have our own input into what we're teaching and we use examples, real-life examples or experiences we've had to enrich the teaching process. Yep. But it's really important that we adhere to the basic standards of the course we're teaching, whether they, in Australia, that might be a training package, so such as the elements and performance criteria, as well as looking at things such as moderation, validation, and how that has affected the development of the course, and ensuring we incorporate those aspects into our teaching well.
Yeah.
So incorporating both our experience and writing it down, but making sure that we meet those standards to ensure our students all receive the same level of training.
Yeah, that's so important nowadays, in particular with compliance obligations and the like. Yeah. It's very important. So there's a balance. I'm drifting back to about 2002 now, where my workplace supervisor in that same organisation then proceeded to say to me, hey, it's really great that we've got this knowledge, and there's a balance between the need to know, which is the majority, and the nice to know, which are the industry stories and the additions of information that you might want to add and so forth. And I think more so now in that validation outcomes, moderation outcomes should be respected within the workplace and with the training environment. However, there is that balance, isn't there, in that a lecturer or an instructor still needs to be given permission to be themselves in the classroom. However, all of those performance criteria and alike within a training package do need to be addressed. And if there's key directives coming out of the validation session in regards to assessment and alike, then they need to be respected and adhered to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. So it's a very important point. All right, let's take a think about how do we engage some of our students now. So now we've moved into the classroom in this conversation. We've moved into the classroom. What are some great ways to engage our student cohorts? So one of the things that I immediately think of is before my students would arrive, I would spend at least an hour setting up the classroom for action-based learning.
Yeah.
So I was big, and I remain big, on bringing bits and pieces in with me. If I go and teach at another campus, I'd load up the fleet car the day before with boxes and boxes and microscopes and the like, and away I'd go, and I'd arrive there an hour before, and I'd set up the classroom so that when people walked in, they realised, wow, I'm in for a really interesting day here today. This is going to be a really good workshop.
Yeah. The other side of action-based learning too, not just the actual doing of particular skills, is that research has shown that even when we're just moving and we're learning something, we actually learn better. The movement doesn't even have to be related to what we're doing, but when people are not static and sitting still, they learn better. So, you know, that really flips on the head the traditional sit in rows, sit still, listen to what I'm saying. People don't actually learn well that way.
That's right. And you want them to retain that knowledge, which we'll talk about at a later in another podcast, but you want them to retain that knowledge because it just makes your life easier.
Absolutely.
You don't be going back over the same stuff or doing assessment resets because someone failed or you've got half the class failed and so you're giving them a second opportunity. You want them all to pass.
Yeah.
And it alleviates your teaching timetable.
You know, I hate it when you go into a class and what did we talk about yesterday? And you have crickets.
Yes, yes.
Science. No sound. Yeah. No one remembers. Yeah. You know, that's not beneficial for your students. It's not beneficial for you
for
either.
For your self-esteem, you spent 8 hours talking to them and they retained nothing. What will they retain today? Exactly right. Yeah, it's a very important. So action-based learning. So I would bring in small pieces of equipment or small workplace examples, not huge amounts of, you know, forklifting equipment into the classroom. None of that. But, you know, some stuff where people could pass it around, they could touch it, they could feel it during the lecturette, while the lecture's taking place. And that way everybody remains engaged in the process. And they can feel free to stop and say, sorry, what was this piece of equipment used for again? And you can reiterate that, because if one person's not clear, probably the majority aren't. So it makes for a really good facilitation process rather than domination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know from my perspective as a student, the one major thing I want from my lecturer or my instructor is feedback. You know, if I get an assessment back, what's the first thing you go to see? Your feedback and your grade.
Yeah.
So sometimes we can be a little hesitant about giving feedback, especially when it's corrective feedback. But it's such an important part of learning and of teaching. But if we can flip your mindset and think about from the student's perspective, they really want to learn.
Yeah.
And the way they're going to learn is when they get feedback, either keep doing this well, or you need to change this. And it needs to be really specific. Yeah. So feedback, often we don't see feedback as a teaching tool. But it's a really important component of teaching and ensuring people become competent. So when we're giving feedback, to make sure it's specific. So good job, or, you know, nice work. That doesn't tell people anything.
No.
You know, it might be a bit of warm and fuzzy, and it might be appropriate occasionally, but true specific feedback isn't excellent way of enhancing a student's practice.
Yes.
So making sure, you know, when you give feedback, you know, if it's a written assessment, it might be that your essay didn't include this, this, and this, but it did include that, that, and that.
Mm-hmm.
Keep doing more of that, and next time include this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually gives them the bones to be able to build on what they already know. Mm-hmm. If you just say, 50%. It tells them nothing and it gives them no direction of where to go in the future. Yep. If you're doing a practical demonstration or they're learning practical skills, it might be that, you know, if you put your thumb on the end of the syringe rather than your index finger, you'll have more control or whatever it is. So really specific about what they need to do better or more of. So if they're doing something really well, explain this is what you're doing well, this is why it's working, and keep doing it.
And we're all busy, right?
Yes.
We're all really busy as faculty members or as education managers, you know, you're always really busy. But the key to it as well is it's got to be timely.
Yes.
So, you know, look, you know, I guarantee you all of us have been there at some point in our careers through faculty not being replaced, and so now we're doing, you know, 1.5 jobs and scenarios like that for a period of time. And what you'll get is you'll get a build-up of 40 assignments, written assignments, sitting on your desk, and you'll get to them in about 3 or 4 weeks' time. Get them graded all in one go. You'll spend a day and a half doing that and get them back to the students. But in that time frame, of course, the academic journey has progressed and the feedback is no longer relevant because they can't go back and correct before they've moved on to the next phase of the assessment task. So really important, if at all possible, to try and get that feedback in regards to written assignments within 2 weeks back to the students. And I think also the verbal feedback, you know, that formative feedback taking place in a timely fashion as well. You don't want to give feedback a week later because you just ran out of time last week in the classroom.
No.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, when you're thinking about feedback, the easy way to frame it for yourself to know that you're doing it well or you're on your way to doing it well is that you only give feedback about what someone is doing well and they need to keep doing, what they're not doing well or what they need to change. And that needs to be really specific, not just you're not doing it well. It needs to be this one, two, three things you need to be improved in this way by doing this. So it needs to be really clear.
Yep.
Not just it's not being done well. You need to give really clear guidance on how to perform better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really critical.
Yeah.
And as you said, it needs to be timely.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Don't be afraid to give that feedback. It's really important. You know, if you offend someone, well, that's unfortunate, but at least they're going to be safe in the workplace.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, Kate, what about group work?
Yes. I am a fan of group work in the right context. Mm-hmm. I don't like group work just for the sake of group work because it's fashionable I'm not a huge, personally, because it's my personality. I don't particularly love discussion-based group work, but where there's a real purpose to it, then yes, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
So things like a project, it doesn't have to be long, but in the classroom, it might be, I need you to do this activity, create this piece of work. You know, there's a real purpose to it, is really, really valuable. Things like peer teaching as a way of group work is really valuable.
Yeah.
What about you? What do you use? Now,
what's peer teaching?
Peer teaching, where you have students teach each other. So you may have done a demonstration, or they may have watched it online, or they may have done it in the workplace, and they're coming back and they're teaching one, two other peers. And they swap those roles. And it could be group peer teaching where they all interact and, you do this bit next and then someone else chips in, or now you do it, this part is this way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a collaborative learning process.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. And in that way, also, you're sort of teaching them what is constructive feedback.
Yes.
So, because that's going to transfer to the workplace as well. You know, that's really important, those skills, rather than just saying, you know, you're doing this wrong and, you know, follow me. So important. I've seen all of that happen, and I've done all of that as well in different contexts. But then I've also seen one instructor who I was working with in the Pacific, where I was coaching them in the classroom. And what they did is then they broke their cohort into four groups. So they had they broke the classroom up into four groups. They had groups of approximately four in each group, and then they spent about 20 minutes working on the question. On the whiteboard, relating to the maritime industry, so maritime safety, shipping, commercial shipping, so big, you know, safety issues relating to that sector. So after 20 minutes, then they documented just in rough notes what they discovered. They all had to do that. And then unexpectedly, then he walked around and he moved one person from each table and swapped them over. So basically an ambassador that each group was moved into a different subgroup. And then from there, very similar to what you're talking about, is then they provide the peer teaching to each group to discuss, this is what our table learnt, this is why we came to these conclusions, how do we differ?
Mm.
And then there was another 20-minute consultative discussion in those small groups. And then those groups, as individual groups, then stood and then gave a very brief 5-minute summary of, this is what we learnt from engaging with this process and with each other. And it was really interesting how that table over there originally came to that conclusion, because we hadn't thought of that. And so all up, there's, you know, probably around about 50 minutes of engaging learning taking place based upon a lecturette that went for about 20 minutes earlier, and then a written question up on the whiteboard.
Yeah.
So it's really quite dynamic.
Mm. I think that's a really important point, that it has to have a specific purpose and be directed. I have been in classes where you can tell that this is just to fill up
half
an hour. Yeah, you don't want that. It really has to be directed and well thought out, and your learning outcomes of this activity needs to be really clear up front.
Yes, it does. It has to be relevant.
Yes.
It's the old Malcolm Knowles, you know, adult learning principles. It must be relevant. That's right. Because if you can see through it as a lecturer watching from a distance, guaranteed the cohort can.
Mm.
They're in it every day of the week.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, the students, I think it's really important, I'm probably digressing a little bit, that you respect their time and their effort. You know, it's a huge commitment to come and do a qualification.
Yeah.
So if you're wasting their time,
yeah,
because you've underprepared or you're not quite sure what the purpose of this group work is, then that's actually, to me, disrespectful.
Yeah.
For them. They're investing their time, their money, their effort. So it should, you know, we should be respectful of them as well.
And leading on from that, you know, the empathy, you're right, the empathy of the student is often overlooked, and it shouldn't be. And it's often overlooked also in the context of, yes, you might be underprepared, or I've seen many times where instructors, obviously trainers, come in with more knowledge than the cohort. They haven't prepared, and then they proceed to pretty much speak with their knowledge over the top of the cohort's understanding,
yeah,
well above their knowledge. You can see that the cohort's got no idea what you're talking about. You need to actually tone down the level of complexity, yeah, and actually present the information to the cohort group in front of you. So that, and they'll do that for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And then it's lunchtime. See you after lunch. I'm sure the students are dreading going back after lunch, I'm sure, mm, because when I leave after the coaching session, I've had enough, you know.
Yeah.
So it's really important to respect the time and the dignity of the cohort, and importantly, don't dominate the session.
Mm.
So there is a balance between, you do need the cohort being given opportunity to provide input, mm, and to share information, their experiences, their life experiences. But it's also, you know, and so you do need, in some sort of context, you need that group work sort of process, yeah, taking place within the dynamics of the training room. But you don't, at the same time, the other extreme is you don't want to be dominating with your wealth of knowledge, mm-hmm, and just lecturing people for 2.5 hours without even stopping to ask, yeah, a question, or a summary is not even considered,
yeah,
in those sessions. So very important to respect the cohort, mm, and their time. So yes, important to have some collaboration taking place. It's also important to lead the discussion and make sure it's relevant collaboration, yeah, but at the same time, that balance of don't dominate.
Yeah, and I think that ties nicely back to what we were discussing before about the standards of the training, or the, you know, going back to the learning objectives or the training package, and then scaffolding that training, mm-hmm, on from, yep, there. So it's, yep, all very, very structured.
Yep.
It might seem unstructured in the classroom to, yep, some extent, but there is a real underlying structure. So the student is gaining knowledge and skills over time, and you facilitate that process.
Yes, yes. Absolutely, and that's the craft of teaching, isn't it? If you look at a session plan, it should be, many session plans are very brief, and we'll talk about this another day, but they're very brief, they're not in detail, they're largely irrelevant, there are a couple of, you know, half a dozen subheadings, and that's not a session plan. But if you look at a well-prepared session plan, there's a lot of underlying planning that, mm, creates a very natural sort of learning journey over a three-hour period in a session. Mm. Which the cohort is never aware of.
No, and then you've got the multiple session plans that all tie in, yes, together across and a term, why, semester, yeah, weeks. So it is very complex.
It is. And so when we talk about this sort of discussion about teaching techniques, we always affirm techniques because, yeah, we like to show respect to the craft of teaching, because, mm, they're really not tips.
No.
This stuff takes a long time to learn and to refine, and it really is part of the fabric of an education practitioner. So techniques is important.
Yeah.
Peer-to-peer learning we've spoken about.
Yeah. Big fan of peer-to-peer learning. As you know, I go on about it quite a bit.
You do. But then you've seen it successful in the classroom, so, yeah, so it's great. Walk and learn. So we all, most of us, if we're delivering a trade qualification, at some point, many of us will be delivering work, health and safety.
Yes.
So
work, one of the safety, first things you generally, yeah, address. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Someone has to in the faculty team. And if you get handed the baton, then, you know, you hold your breath and try and work out how you can fill up 2 days or 3 days. So for me, what I used to do is I used to walk around the campus or walk around the district nearby the campus about the day before, And I'd make a note of as many hazards as I could find. So I'd look for trip hazards, and I'd look for this, and I'd look for that. I'd list as many as I could. And the next day, I'd then gather the cohort together. Right, we do more than this, but one of the practical activities that we would do is break the cohorts into groups, and then I'd send them off. I'd send them southeast, west, so forth, with their hazard report checklist that they had to go and find as many hazards as they could. And what they're doing when they're doing that is they're walking and they're learning.
Yeah.
That interaction, that movement, as you were saying before, is very powerful. Sometimes I'd take them on a lecture, but I'd walk them many times, in fact, because of the vocational area that I worked in. Many times I would take them out and I would walk and I would lecture and I would instruct and I'd talk about the natural environment. And it was very powerful.
I think if you give more detail, because you're teaching plants, it will help to show what you were doing.
So I was teaching botany.
Botany, my apologies, Lee. Obviously not my vocational area.
Botany and soil science were two of the key examples of this taking place. So I taught from, say, the diploma down to Certificate 2, so it varied across the context of the AQF. However, what we would do is we'd grab the cohort and we'd have it all prepared, all pre-planned, a lot of planning involved, and I'd take them into the field and I'd look at this particular plant species and I'd give them all the history to it, the botany of key components of the plant, so they could remember and retain the knowledge moving forward. And that's how we did that process. But
you did a lot as well along the coastal trails, so walking trails that they could go back to as well.
Always. That's right. That's right. It was always done in a logical way. So when we would do the process, so I'd give them a list of the plants initially. They have no idea what the Latin names were, which is fine. But as we would go out, I'd say, so here's plant number one, here's plant number two. As you're walking through here next week in your own time, take a look back through the list, make a note of where you're going to find this plant on the trail, and so that in your own time you're able to transfer the knowledge and be self-sufficient moving forward. We'd revisit those plants because, you know, you're talking 60 Latin names, so we'd revisit those two or three times to ensure that they were supported with the learning journey. Soil science, the same, very similar, where we'd look at different soil profiles. It can be done, though. It can be done. I've seen it done with the maritime industry with regards to... so I'm stepping out of my zone now. So, but... you know, those safety pods, you know, those lifeboats, bright orange, they're sort of always set up on an angle off the back of a shipping liner. Well, I've seen them, I've joined groups like that where I've been coaching and observing and writing notes on behalf of the instructor. And why they're out there, they're doing all of that. They're doing that practical instruction. And it's really what it is theory instruction, but outside, while you're moving, while you're talking, while you're doing what the vocation would expect during the day. And it's surprising how much people retain as opposed to sitting and looking at a PowerPoint.
Yeah. I just think, like your example of learning the botanical names of plants, you know, you could have shown me a picture or a press sample in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually go out and see it and feel it, smell it, all of those things are going to enhance my learning rather than just sitting you talking to me about it.
Well, you see, and then at the same time, what they were doing is they were taking cuttings of those plants, bringing them back in the laboratory, and then I was instructing them on how to dissect those plants and press them two-dimensionally. And so they had that to take away with them as well. So that in 3 weeks' time, they had their own botanical collection that they would take with them. So, yes, it's a combination of all of those things. But without the walking and the learning, it all falls apart.
Really important.
Yeah. What about facilitating workstations?
I like workstations.
Yep.
One, because it ensures your learners are all doing something, you know, especially if you're doing practical skills. It can work with theory as well, but it ensures people aren't just left on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm.
So workstations, you know, you might set up 2, 3, 6. It really doesn't, the number doesn't matter.
Yep.
There's a couple of different methods that people use for workstations. Some will have the workstations all learning the same topic or skill or theory, but in a different way. So you'll go through multiple, all learning, all delivering or teaching the same, exactly the same thing, just in a different format.
So that might be things like video reviews.
Yes.
Someone, one group might be sitting on the table looking at it, looking at the laptop, watching a short video.
Yep.
It might be a journal review.
Yep.
It might be the handling of equipment in the classroom. It might be answering a predetermined probing question.
Yep.
All those sorts of techniques then can be used.
Yep. And the other sort of way you can do workstations is where you have them learning different things at each station and, again, move around. Mm-hmm. So each of them, both methods, the students go around all of the workstations.
Yep.
Whereas the one where they're all learning the same thing is real consolidation.
Yeah.
And it, you know, each time it's retrieving and, you know, learning, relearning, retrieval practice.
Yeah.
Whereas the second one, they're learning new things at different ones, but they'll be related.
Yes.
They won't be completely different.
Right.
They will be related.
Yeah.
But it ensures it creates diversity in the classroom, collaboration. It ensures
it's not dominated by one outspoken student all the time.
No. Yeah. You can include group work within those workstations. It could be singular or one or two students, or it could be a group work at each station. Yep. There's lots of different varieties and ways that you can facilitate workstations. But you'll find you don't tend to have the student who is sitting at the back of the room not engaging.
Yeah.
It's a much more engaging process, and it's hard for those less confident students to hide or not participate. It's a really good way of, especially where you have groups that aren't engaging well or are very timid or don't know each other very well, to start to engage with each other.
I'm a huge believer when you do that sort of approach, like workstations, I'm a huge believer in timelines. So you've got to stay up front as the trainer. You've got to stay up front, 15 minutes each workstation, 10 minutes, whatever you want, and then we're going to move. And then at the end of that 10 minutes, if they're not finished, bad luck, you know, move on to the next one. And you've got to keep it associated with a timeline. It drives me bananas when I'm sitting there, you know, observing other trainers, and I'm recording, you know, coaching process for them, and it drives me bananas when they just overlook that, because it doesn't actually create the atmosphere or the context of the workplace within the training room, and it should.
And you're right, it's so important to say this is going to take this long for each station or however you've got it set up. Because one, if we've got a lot of time, we tend to procrastinate.
Yeah.
So it also stops that and makes people, especially perhaps, give a slightly shorter time than they need, so that you really get people
focused
and straight into it.
Yep.
Having really clear instructions at each station is also vital, because if they get there and they don't know what to do, whether it's a single person or a group, then they're not going to get anything out of it, and they're going to spend most of the time trying to work out what is it I'm supposed to be doing and not about what am I learning.
Yeah.
So having those really clear instructions and trialing it. So trial on people before you do it in the classroom. You know, do you understand what I'm wanting?
The instructions?
Yes.
So if you've got a group of, say, 4 workstations set up, and it takes you 10 minutes to introduce what the workstation activities are going to be about, as you discuss with the cohort and introduce the process that's about to commence. And then, so now you've got, so that's 10 minutes, and then you've got 40 minutes, because 10 minutes for each workstation moving around the room. So now that's 50 minutes, and then you've got 10 minute summary at the end where you'll bring them all together. So there's an hour a really entertaining, an educational process, right? There's an hour where everyone, and you're right, in particular, it works really well with new groups when they've just gotten together, because it breaks down the barriers and, you know, people can engage and, you know, all of that. It creates good classroom dynamics. But my question to you, and I often present it to faculty groups, is what are you doing in that hour? So I've seen woeful examples of instructors or trainers or lecturers getting up and going making a cup of coffee, coming back 25 minutes later. How are you going?
All right, so I wouldn't recommend the coffee. Keep your coffee to the coffee break as much as possible. Feedback. So we already talked about feedback. So moving around the groups.
Are you sitting feedback. Down the front?
No.
You're moving.
Move around the groups. Observe what's going. Might be pose a question, you know, what happens if you do this? Or why did you do it like that? So ensuring that their thinking is, they're actually required to think and not just do.
Yeah.
And it depends on the workstation as well. For some, it can be very labor intensive and you need a instructor at every workstation. So it really depends on what you're doing. Sometimes you can just float around, but make sure you go to every group.
Yeah.
You don't want to just focus on one group, or you might need to stay at one station. So you will,
it's complex.
You will get to see every group, but you might need to stay at that one. So you should be visible and accessible during the workstation sessions.
Are you standing? And so this is what makes or breaks, right? So are you standing over the top of the table with your hands on your hips, watching on? Or how do you position yourself body-wise, you know, body language?
Well, I'm a bit of a floater. I like to walk around and just kind of stick my head in, have a bit of a listen. And if it's appropriate, you know, what about this, pose a question. Or if they're really struggling, we'll go through the instructions again. Or, you know, just do some clarification if it's required. I'm much more of a... I'm not in the in-your-face person because the workstations is about them themselves.
Yeah.
Self-discovery of information and skills and developing their problem-solving, all of that. So if I butt in all the time, that's not going to happen. But there are times where you do need to step in and assist them so that they can move forward with that process.
I've seen trainers say to me afterwards, I know I struggled with that. I tried to do the workstation process because you told me it was a good idea. So I tried. I knew you were coming in to coach, so I tried it. But I didn't know what to do with myself at the time. And I say to them, you know, because the students seemed like they were doing the right thing, so I just left them to it. And I say to them, you know, it's enormously powerful if you just grab a chair, drag it up to that table randomly, and sit amongst the group and say nothing. Just sit. And I guarantee you, within 2 minutes, they'll start involving you in the conversation because your presence is power.
Yeah.
And so they'll be uneasy about you sitting there, so they'll start asking you questions and the like, and you can then provide a little bit of input, and then, as you say, move on to the next desk.
Yeah.
So it's really important. It's a great tool to use, collaborative workstations in the classroom, really powerful and usually very successful. But it's really important that you sort of work out what you're going to do.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, like we were talking about with group work, there has to be a purpose to what you're doing, to each of the workstations. Yes. It needs to be a very defined purpose. So again, it's back to your planning.
Mm.
It's not just... oh, I know this is a good thing, you know, workstations are good for student engagement, etc., and so I'll just set some up. It actually needs to be more strategic than that.
And so it's actually quite complex to develop the session plan, because you need all of that underpinned underneath. Yes. And then you've got to set it up before they walk in too.
And that can help you with what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Because you actually know what the students are supposed to be getting out of these workstations. And
that's
so, you know, you can have pre-prepared probing questions ask the groups and things like that while you're moving around.
Yeah. All right. So you know, there's a lot of faculty out there who have covered off their formal qualifications, and they've walked away, and they've been given, you know, a role of being in the classroom 4 days a week, and it can be daunting, and it can be challenging. Even though you've got, in Australia, you've got your Certificate 4 in TAE, which is the minimum qualification that you need to be an adult educator. But it can still be daunting. You can be new to it, having completed it, and then now you're teaching large groups every day. Or you could have done your formal qualification 10 years ago and now be thinking, well, maybe my skills and approaches to teaching are outdated. And there's always self-doubt. You know, it's a challenging role to be an instructor or to be a trainer. And so, without meaning to present a commercial product, but really, you know, we do provide that support through our business. So if you go to www.transformationconsultancy.com, you'll be able to find that support that can often be quite valuable. And it's developed over 30 years of training experience between the two of us. So if you go there and if you look up, there's a very clearly labeled page, which is vocational education and training. And if you go there onto that page, then you'll see a link which is titled Vet Resources. There's then a little button in there with regards to online courses. If you click on there, then you'll come up and you'll see a series of courses that you can select from, all clearly labelled, all clearly defined.
And if you're interested in coaching as well, we offer that service as well. You can find information on our website.
That's right, that's right. So have a little bit of a think about that. Hopefully, I think these discussions are really valuable. I know if I'd been given access to these discussions, you know, 5 years into my teaching career, my life would have been so much easier. And so all we're doing is sharing some of that knowledge that's been developed over those years. And hopefully it's a benefit to those listening in.
And if you are finding this a benefit, we'd really appreciate it if you'd leave us a review on your podcast.
Fantastic. Post. All right. Platform. All the best. And we'll chat in 2 weeks' time.